All right, so hello everyone. Long time no see, and now if we meet, we meet on Zoom. But you know, that's fine. Also, that's fine anyway. Personally, I hate giving classes, lectures on Zoom, for two reasons. First of all, everyone hates Zoom. I don't think anyone likes Zoom. It's a compromise. It's not lechatchila, what we call. And second of all, we like the in person. You know, when you feel the people. You know if your class is a good class, if it's a bad class, you can see on their faces. And Zoom, it's difficult. I cannot feel, cannot touch the people. It's different on Zoom, but I hope it would be at least as good as I hope the last classes were. So welcome to the fourth class of Basic Introduction to Halacha. Today, we're going to change our discussions in the last three classes. If you remember, we talked about how exactly was halacha developed. How was halacha formed? We started talking about that. What is halacha in general? What is halacha? What happened after the Talmud? Then we moved in the second meeting to talk about the three early halachic writings. At the beginning of halacha, we spoke about the Rif. You have those notebooks with the people that I shared with you. We spoke about the Rif, about the Rambam, Maimonides. We spoke about the Rosh and his son, Rabbi Yaakov ben HaRosh ben Asher, Bal HaTur, he wrote the Tur, the book of the Tur. 2 weeks ago, we spoke a little bit about Sephardim and Ashkenazim, the separation between, if you remember, Zarama, Rabbi Moshe Iserlish, and Rabbi Yosef Karo, the wonderful story of Rabbi Moshe Iserlish, who, when he wrote down a book for decades, and when he found that someone in Israel that he haven't known wrote down the same book, he said, "You know what? I'm not going to publish it. I'm not going to print it. I'm going to change it and write down a shortcut." And after he wrote down the shortcut, he realized and he found out that that person as well wrote down a shortcut. And then he said, "You know what? I'm not going to publish my shortcut. I'm just going to write down notes that I have on his publication, on his book." So that's what we did last time, and we spoke a little bit about Ashkenazim and Sfaradim because of one of your questions. I don't remember exactly who asked this very good questions. What's today in Israel, and how are things today in the Israeli culture, in the Israeli presence? We talked about it, and we said that, you know, it differs between every group. We cannot say that there is one, but I can tell you that today, Baruch Hashem, it's way better than it was 20 or 30 years ago, and I'm sure 100% that in 20 years ahead, it would be even better than how it is today. So what do I want to do today? Today I want to discuss, I think, what could be the first class of Basic Introduction to Halacha, but we're going to do it at the fourth, and this is how do we decide what Halacha is. Given the fact that we know how Halacha was written, we know the differences between the books, we know the generations and generations that wrote down after the Talmud, the Mishnah, the Talmud, the Rif, the Rosh, the Rambam. We know the Shulchan Aruch, the Rama. We know what's now. What's going to happen now? If a rabbi, and not only a rabbi, let's start with a rabbi, but I'm going to give you two cases. First case is a rabbi. A rabbi in Israel, and also here, but in Israel it's very strong, because most of the Israeli synagogues are synagogues, they're shuls, they're not congregations, they're not communities, which means that a rabbi of a shul, a rabbi of a synagogue, is not like we have in our mind, as we know our rabbis here in Toronto, or in North America, or anywhere else outside of Israel. The rabbi in Israel, he's most of the time being posek halacha. He receives halachic questions from everyone that he knows, and also from people he don't know. They just got his phone number, they have his WhatsApp, they have his email address, and he receives countless of halachic questions, and not necessarily he's a rabbi of a community. Sometimes he davens or prays in a shul with other people. There's no membership to this shul, like a stiblach, and that's what he does mainly in his daily life, would be to give classes, shiurim, lectures, and most of the day would be to answer halachic questions. So first case would be a rabbi in Israel, but also here, he receives an halachic question from someone regarding his fleishik fork that was mixed into the dairy yogurt, for example. Or that the fleishik spoon was touched the dairy yogurt. Something that happens all the time. to all of us. What should you do? Maybe one of you will tell me you need to take the spoon, put it into a plant, into the ground. We know all those, which is actually true, but we're not going to discuss it now. Let's say he received a question which is very complicated. What does he do in order to answer this question? Where does he even start in order to answer this question? First case. Second case, and I will talk about it a little bit more during the second part of this class, would be how do we, as what I called Balei Batim. Balei Batim in Jewish world would be those who live their lives. We, fortunately, unfortunately, we're not rabbis. We don't use our day every all day long to learn halacha, to teach halacha, to learn Judaism, to teach Judaism. We try to enrich our daily life and our daily routine as much as possible. What we don't necessarily go into dive into halachic text every day and every hour of our day. So if we have an halachic questions, how can we answer without a rabbi our halachic questions? And I will address this question towards the second part of my shiur, because I think it's very fundamental. I think it's very important, because having ourselves as answering our halachic questions is something that is even more vital than rabbis. All right, because halacha is not for the rabbis. Halacha is for all of us. This is something that I want. I hope I can convey in this series in general that halacha is not something that sits there at the top of the building, but rather it's something that every one of us can learn, every one of us can engage into it, every one of us can actually do in our daily life. So how can we answer our daily halachi questions without addressing the rabbi? I will send our sources again on the chat. Here you go, you can open it. This is our sources for today. Oh, and I promise you today, I told you today we will also dive a little bit into the differences between Orthodoxy, Conservative, and Reform. All right? I'm not going to give, I told you, every class can be a mini series by itself. I'm not going to give the entire historical overview of how exactly those three sections were developed and were created in Jewish world. It's a fascinating topic, not for today, but rather given the fact that we know the differences in general, all of us, between Reform, Conservative, and Orthodoxy, how the halacha comes into difference between those three streams, between those three groups, and what exactly is their halachic approach for the three of them. But before we get there, let's first of all ask the question, how do we decide what the halacha is? That's my question. If you can open, please, your sources. One second. I'll open mine as well. All right. If you can open your sources, I just send it in our. It's a very short one. Send it in our chat. We need to understand, before we address this question, we need to understand a very basic rule in that case. And the rule is, as we'll see in a minute, the most basic rule in halacha, and it doesn't matter if you're a rabbi, or if you're a lawyer, or a doctor, or a scientist, or a bus driver, is when you approach an halachic question, you pay respect, first of all, to the generations before you. That's the most basic halachic law, rule, that you can find before someone comes and addresses a halachic question. Which means, in other words, that when someone receives an halachic question, or if you have a halachic question, what you need to do is to go back like an archaeologist. All right, you need to dig back all the way until you can receive something you can work with, and then try to go ahead generation after generation after generation after generation until you get to one rabbi or one book that was written one generation before you, and then only then you can add from yourself your conclusion. But your answer must be connected with respect to everything that was written before you. Now, we're not for no reason being called Am HaSefer, the nation of books, because we're a nation of libraries. That's what we have. We have a huge library in our back. Everyone carries his own library. And what we do as Jews is write books and read books, write halachic books and learn halachic books, and more and moreover. That means that every rabbi or a person who comes and asks or being asked an halachic question, first of all, needs to know what book to open. But when he opens the book, he needs to pay respect to the generations before you. I'll give you an example. It's not a new thing, what I'm saying right now. It's actually being mentioned already in the Talmud. The Talmud itself says that, that we need to pay respect to the generations before us. Look, for example, at the first source that I sent you right here. Chizkiah was so impressed by Rabbi Yochanan's comment. There is a discussion between this Rabbi Chizkiah and this Rabbi Yochanan, but each of them gave a statement, a comment, and Chizkiah was so impressed by this Rabbi Yochanan's comment, without getting into his comment, that he exclaimed about him, "This is not a human being," he said. Now, we need to understand Chizkiah was a generation after, all right? After Rabbi Yochanan, he said, "This Rabbi Yochanan was not a human being, but an angel." Some say that he said, "This is an ideal human being." Now, on a similar note, Rabbi Zera said that Rabbi Bar Zimuna, different rabbis, again in Babylon, all right, if you remember the basic introduction to Talmud, I throw you back to Babylon right now. If the early generations are characterized as sons of angels, we are the sons of men. And if the early generations are characterized as the sons of men, we are akin to donkeys. All right? In other words, back then, already in the Talmud, they say, our early generations, the rabbis before us, are bigger, stronger, and better than us. Now, some would say, how come? Right? Well, the generation, every generation that follows is smarter than the generation before him. Why? Because he can learn from his mistakes, right? I don't think any of us would prefer living 100 years ago than living in this generation. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. With COVID, with all our problems in our world, I still think really that our world is better than 100 years ago. I don't know, but do you agree? Just to see her, if we're in person, I could see her, you're nodding. Terry, I see not so much, all right? I think that we live in a generation in the world better than 100 years ago, and I think, I would assume, this is how history goes. In 100 years ago, it would be better than today. That's what I assume. Why? Because as the generations evolve, they learn from our mistakes, they develop new skills, new things. You know that every in each one of us is 3 or 4 or 5 times richer than Shlomo HaMelech. We need to understand that. We say that Shlomo HaMelech was rich. He is rich compared to the poorest of poorest of poorest people that today in our world. The poverty line in Canada and also in Israel is way above. The poverty line is way above what a rich person would be in the Tanakh times. We need to understand that. That when we, in our terms of world, we live in a higher level. In any case, doesn't matter how much money you have, you're still going to be living in a higher level than how they lived back then. You have water, you have electricity, Baruch Hashem, that's always better. You don't need to go to the well to take water. And it's right not only for that. I would assume that it's right also for halacha. I would assume that a rabbi 20 years from now would be better rabbi, a more smarter one with more knowledge than what? Than a rabbi 20 years ago. That's what I would assume. But this is different, folks. It's different. In halacha, we pay respect and we always assume that we are smaller. Smaller in terms of wisdom, smaller in terms of power than the generations before us. So it doesn't matter what question we are being asked or we are asking. First of all, we need to dive backwards in time. But look, it's not the only thing. Look at the second source. Similarly, Rabbi Yochanan said, the hearts, the wisdom of the early sages were like a doorway to the entrance hall of the temple, which was 20 by 40 cubits. And the heart of the later sages were like the doorway to the sanctuary, which was 10 by 20 cubits. And we, our hearts, are like the eye of a fine needle. All right? So what I want to just show you is that when we say last generations were bigger, were better, it's not a new invention. It was already back then. So those rabbis who said the rabbis before them are bigger than them, we say to those rabbis, you are bigger than us. First of all. Second of all, how come does halacha change? If so, how did everything that we talked about in the last four meetings, how come it is right? How come Rabbi Yosef Karo decided to write down a book after that Rabbi Yaakov ben Harosh wrote down his book Arba'at HaTurim? How come the Rambam wrote down a book after the Rif wrote down a book? How come? If the early generations are better than us, how come there all the time there is new halachot, there's new books, there are new stuff? So, two things. First of all, halacha changes. Even if you will hear it's not, even if you think it's not, even if you think it's due and it's very critical, halacha changes. How? Wait a second, we will talk about it. Halacha changes. But every time that halacha changes, every change that halacha is doing needs to be by one of those two streams. Or an active change, which means there was a rabbi, or usually a group of rabbis, who decided, and we'll learn how, decided that one halacha that was before them is or invalid or needs to be changed because of time. Or second of all, can be a passive change. And a passive change, folks, is a change that comes, derives from the people, from the nation, from the public, and not from the layer of the rabbis, but from underneath upwards, and not from upwards downwards. That's two ways that halacha changes. But how does a group of rabbis change halacha if we say that you need to pay respect to the generation before you? How come they can do it? So look, please, in Yoma. No, not in Yoma. I will tell you, I will give you, you know what? I will give you it from I didn't put it in the source, but you need to believe me in that case. The, I think it was a Rashba. He was a rabbi. In the Middle Ages, it was around the 13th century. And he wrote down a book where he says, you know how come I disagree with earlier rabbis before me? And he quotes actually a philosopher. I don't know if it's Aristotle or Plato, but he quotes a Greek philosopher and he said that the generations that are before me are actually giants. They're giants. They're huge. I am a dwarf next to them. That's how he says, I'm a dwarf next to them. But when the dwarf sits on the shoulders of a giant, he can see way, way further. All right? So yes, the early generations, the generations before us are giants. They're bigger than us. And we will be bigger than the generation that will come. That's my condolences. I can say, yeah, we will be better than the generations to come. But as small as we are, when we sit on the soul, on the shoulders, on the back of the past generations, we can see further and further. And it's not only we're not sitting only on the shoulders of one generation, of one giant. We have plenty of generations behind us. We have plenty of giants that sits on the shoulders of each other, and we're on the top. Of course we're short. Of course we're small. But we have everything that they made for us, everything that they created. We can take it and now examine it in the light of our reality and in the tool that we have. I'll give you an example. I live in a building where on Shabbos we have a Shabbos elevator. Shabbos elevator! If my grandfather 100 years ago would hear, I don't know if he knew what elevator is, but never mind. If he would hear that his grand-grandson, who's a rabbi in Shari Tfila, uses an electric elevator on Shabbos? Oh my goodness, how come? Maybe he's Reform, or maybe he's not Jewish, or maybe he's Michiganite. How come he uses an electric elevator on Shabbos? How come? It can't be, right? But halacha changes. When we come to permit elevators on Shabbos elevators, we need to first of all focus and understand backwards, to try to see what our giants that before us said on Shabbos, what the giants two generations ago said about electricity, and only then when we understand where we are now, only then we are allowed to test those statements and this halacha in our eyes, in our tools. And yes, we can say that in our generation, when we have that technology to make sure that when you use an electricity equipment, then you're not going to violate Shabbos, we can say that it is fine. But if we would see, and there are plenty of examples, if you want, I can give you. I think the biggest example might be what we called mesuravot, get refusal, in divorcement. This might be the biggest example of how come halacha has real difficulty in changing, all right? Because not every time it's so easy. Of course we want to change stuff. Here in Shabbos, it was pretty easy. We know what Shabbos is. We know what electricity is. We know how to use electricity because generations before us talked about it. Now we have a new thing called the levator on Shabbos. Oh, matov u'manayim. Let's see how it goes. Let's see how it tests. And then we can say if it's permitted or not and in what conditions. But not everything is that simple. There are stuff in halacha that because we need to base ourselves upon previous generations, those things cannot be changed. Something would never be changed. I when I speak like that, I hear Tuvia, the milk maker from Fiddler on the Roof. When I speak, there's something that can never be changed. But folks, this is right. Some things in halacha would never be changed. Shabbos is Shabbos. Shabbos is Shabbos. Electricity in Shabbos is wrong. Electricity in Shabbos is forbidden. How come today there are different stuff that we can use in order to, for example, one of the questions that is being asked today is about driverless cars, for example, right? Like we know there's autonomous cars, they can drive without a driver. Can you just pop in, pop out from that? So for example, in order to answer this question, let's go back to what? To the Mishnah, let's go to the Talmud, let's go afterwards to the Rif, we see what they say on cars, not cars, but on horses, on donkeys, on Shabbos. Let's see what they say on Shabbos. Let's go all the way further to the Tool, to the Rambam, to the Shulchan Aruch, to the Rama, Rabbi Moshe Easterlich. Let's go all the way further to the 90s, 20th century. Let's go to the 20th century. We'll see Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, who was the biggest postdoc in America. And he wrote when they first opened in New York, the subway that has no driver. It just automatically flows and drives. Can you come back in and out? And we'll see that in his answer, when he relies upon all the giants that were before him, and eventually he says, you know what? Maybe sometimes, if there is no Chil Shabbos, maybe in order to get to Shul, you just come in, you come out, maybe that's fine. Now, I will say, not me, the rabbis in our generation would say, maybe it's like Shabbos elevator, all right? Maybe in what kind it would be fine. But the rabbi 10 years ahead, 20 years ahead, might say, you are right. Maybe there is an halacha room to permit, let's say, this driverless car on Shabbos. But do we want that? Do we want our Shabbos to look like that, that we can drive cars even without a driver? Don't we enjoy our Shabbos as it is today, when we need to walk at the snow, minus 30 degrees outside to shul? Why do we need that? You know, Michael walks 40 minutes every Shabbos back and forth. He would love to have this car, driverless car, that will wait outside his garage, his driveway, will just come in, pop in and pop out at shul. But maybe this is not how we want our Shabbos to be. But in order to answer those questions, we go all the way backwards, and then we go all the way forward until we see our things today. Now you would ask me, but Idan, if it's that simple, how come there are so many disagreements also today on halacha? The way I live their life is not necessarily the way you live your life. The way you live your life is not necessarily the way that your father or mother or even siblings live their life. They have their rabbis, I have my rabbi, you have your rabbis. How come it's all okay if it's so simple? And we just need to pay respect to our generation before us. How come we have all of those machlokot, as we call it in Hebrew, disagreements in halacha? And I want to tell you that. How can I answer this question? First of all, this is part of the system. This is one of the bad things. Some would say bad. I would say it's a good thing. But some would say this is part of the system. A system that always can evolve all the time, never sticks the same halacha, is from the Hebrew word of holech. Walking, moving. It's moving. All the way it's moving. It's an endless, infinite rolling wheel that all the time, like a snowball, all the time gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Sometimes people, when they add their things inside, sometimes they disagree with other things in their generation. And we saw that as an example last class. When I showed you how the Rama and Rabbi Yosef Karo, back then in the 14th, 15th century, when they wrote down their books, Rabbi Yosef Karo wrote down a book for Sephardim, and he just ignored all the traditions that were back then by the Ashkenazi class, the Ashkenazi states, because we live in different places, we have different traditions, we come from different backgrounds, and our rabbis are not the same. That's why, folks, even though we need to still pay respect, this is the bottom line, the common line that everyone agrees. You cannot just renew halacha from your own mind. You cannot just invent or cancel halacha just because you think Doesn't matter how great you are. Just because you think it's not valid anymore, just because it really harms you, or you say it's not democrat or it's immoral, this halacha, if we want to cancel this halacha or to change it, we need to go back all the way and try to understand the essence itself of what our previous generations wrote down. Now, in Jewish history, there were two times where this rule broke. Two times when this rule broke. The first one would be at the Second Temple. In the Second Temple, Judaism experienced something that it has never experienced before. For the first time, Judaism was such a big group, such a strong group, that it, for some reason, succeeded in just diversing themselves into three different groups. When a group is small and weak, sometimes they stick together. And there are people not trying to branch themselves out, right? And to just build themselves a new group. But when a group is strong enough and is confident in themselves, then you can start hear voices of change, voices of revolt sometimes. And that's what happened in Second Temple. In Second Temple, we had this first diversity of Judaism. Judaism branched out to three different groups. The main group was called the Purushim. All right, Purushim, that's how it was called. The second group of the Kohanim, the priests, were not in the Purushim. The priests were in the second group called Tzadokim, from the Mishpacha, the family of Tzadok. They were the family of Tzadokim. And the third smallest group was called Issiim. The Issiim, they're the most interesting group. They lived in the desert and in the Jordan Valley, not far from Yam HaMelach, from the Dead Sea in Israel. And actually in the 50s, if you heard about the Dead Sea Scrolls in the Qumran caves, if you heard of it, about the scrolls of Tanakh and in handwritings of a lot of books of the Tanakh, it was found there that is being dated back to those groups who lived in the desert of those Issiim. They wrote down those books, and we discovered not only the Tanakh, but also other stuff that they wrote down, like there is this scroll, Megillah, called Bnei Ha'ol uvnei Choshech, the sons of light and the sons of darkness, who fight each other, because those Issiim were very much influenced by other groups in Israel, not only in Israel, who believed in what's called duality, dualism. There is good and there is bad, that's all. And all the world is divided into good and bad. There is no complexity. There is no, the world is not complicated. So back then in Second Temple, and again, I'm not going to get into why, what happened, what exactly are the differences between those three groups. Something happened and it was diverse into three. And all the way to the Gemara and the Mishnah, we know there are actually halachot in the Gemara. The Mishnah and the Gemara are a direct continuation of the Purushim, not the Tzadokim and the Issiim. The Issiim assimilated one day and they just disappeared from the world. The Tzadokim as well, they assimilated and they were counted as evil after the Second Temple was destroyed. No more priests. They were very wicked because the Kehuna, the world of the priests back then, was made a lot with business and money, and they bought their there was a lot of stuff when you combine money and power, all right? And they disappeared. And the Purushim continued. And there we know of halachot from Mishnah time, Mishnah in the Second Temple, that they actually discussed halachot. How can we prevent ourselves from being called as Tzadokim or Issiim? And we know that halacha changed when? Because there was diversity and branched out of different groups in Israel. And the Purushim won, and they continued all the way to the Talmud time, etc., etc., etc. Now, during those thousands of years, something happened. There was different groups. Sometimes groups who tried to convert into Christianity. There were different groups in other places of the world. Some Christians tried to say, we are Jews. But in general, Judaism was one strict group, even though they lived in separate places. Let's say the two groups would be Ashkenazi and Sephardi. And then we get to the 18th century. And in the 18th century, guys, in Europe itself, because of, again, reasons that I don't want to get into it right now, Jews started again to question their identity. And for some reason, they tried to say again, wait, do we live our life in the way we need to live our life? Are we upset from the group we identified ourselves with? Should we change the way we live our life? And then Moshe Mendelssohn and Abraham Geiger and different rabbis back then who learned Torah, learn Torah, decided we cannot stay those small Eretz-Kite in their shtetl, because again, we're talking about Poland, Germany in the 18th century. Jews were not assimilated; they were not in the general public in Germany and Poland of back then. They lived in their shtetls within themselves. They were prosecuted because of anti-Semitism, and they said to themselves, "We need to open ourselves to the modern world. We need to open ourselves to what is called the Enlightenment movement." Tnuat Haskala in Hebrew, the Enlightenment movement. Not going to talk about the two. If you want, we can expand our discussion. But in general, science, philosophy, democracy, a lot of stuff that we say, oh, this is beautiful in the world, back then in Europe. And they said, we need to open ourselves to this world. This world is a better word for us. We cannot stay in our shtetl. And they learned Torah. And what happened is, they said, we need to be, and they were a lot influenced by the reform that happened in Christianity before that, with Martin Luther King, all right? We're not going to talk about it now. And they said to themselves, we need to change ourselves from being Bnei Dat Moshe, the sons of the Moses religion, to become Germans Bnei Dat Moshe. We are Germanim Bnei Dat Moshe. We're first Germans. We identify with the country we're in. And again, because Romanticism and a lot of other stuff were very interesting. Why this happened? How come this nationalism of becoming very identified with your country, something that happened back then, and they said we need to be identified with our country to pay gratitude to this country, and at the same time to maintain a religion. But first, we are Germans. And this is, folks, the beginning of the Reform movement. But back then, they did not call themselves Reforms, all right? When Reform movement is start, Reform is change. When a Reform movement changes or becomes Reform, they don't call themselves change. They say we think we continue the way that we're supposed to continue. But this movement, who succeeded very, very much in Europe in the 18th and 19th and the beginning of the 20th century, and at the beginning of the 20th century moved all the way to North America, where it dwells today, where it's thriving, some would say where it's dying, but where it is today in North America. There was a huge rabbi, a giant rabbi, back then in Europe. His name was Chatam Sofer. All right? And the Chatam Sofer said, he saw what happened with the reforms, with those group of Jews who did not have their birds anymore. They dressed up like Germans. They said, they have this statement, I think it's Moshe Mendelssohn. He said, Heye Yehudi beveitcha uGermani betzetcha. Be a Jew in your home, indoors, and be German outside, outdoors. All right? Where their only Judaism was something very nice, very cultured, accompanied them a lot of stuff like biblical criticism. They did not believe in God. They believed that the Tanakh and the Torah were written by humans. They canceled all the obligatory of Torah and mitzvot. And they said, we don't want halacha in the world anymore. So what happened? There was a movement, the rest of the world, the Yiddishkeit world, the Yeshivish world back then, said, led by Chatam Sofer, this rabbi, and he said, Rabbi Avraham Sofer, and he said, no way, we cannot let it happen. And he established new halachot to make him and his crowd more frum, more strict than this new group, in order to separate himself from them. And this group was called, not by themselves, and not by the reform, but many years afterward would be called the Orthodox movement. Now we need to understand, the Orthodox movement is later than the Reform movement. All right? The Reform movement was there first. Orthodoxy is only a response to Reform. It's not that everyone were Orthodox before Abraham Geiger and Moshe Mendelssohn, and they changed themselves. Everyone were Jews. There was no, there were secular Jews, something that had no identity, and there were, most of them were religious Jews. Now, Hasidish, Litvak, there was, again, only Europe. We're not talking about North Africa, and not talking about the Sephardim, all right? Not talking there in a different way. And only in Europe. And the Orthodoxy was formed only after the Reform was formed. And they went all the way right. If the Reform went all the way left, they said, in order to separate us from the Reform, we need to change ourselves. For example, the Reform wanted, for some reason, to have their bima where? We're in Reform shuls. Where is the bima in shul?
Facing west.
No, facing east. Not facing west. But all the way, all the way, all the way. What?
Facing
all the way near the ark. All right, in the old Reformed, like in churches, it was a huge synagogue, a lot of benches, and at the top of it, near the ark, there was a huge bima, and there were chairs, big chairs next to it, like you can see also today in some Orthodox shuls. There was no bima at the middle of it, like we have in Shari Tefillah. And Chatan Sofer said, you know what, in order for us to separate ourselves from this group, because this group is wrong, I am having a psak halacha that every shul, every Orthodox shul from now on needs to have a bima at the center of the shul and not where it is at the beginning, at the end of shul, next to the ark. Now, sometimes you have both. You have an amud and a bima. I'm not talking about that. But this is an example of halacha that changed because of what? Because of a passive change of the nation. Because people started to split themselves. And then 50, 60, 100 years afterwards, a new movement, the newest one, and some would say the earliest one to disappear from the world, we will see, called the conservative movement. And the conservative movement said, you know what? We're not like the Reforms. We love our tradition in halacha. We believe in Torah min Hashamayim. There is a book by Rabbi Heschel, all right, called Torah min Hashamayim, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. The Torah is from the skies. Torah is from heaven. It's divine. We don't want to cancel the fact that the Torah is divine. But on the other hand, we cannot stay this yeshivish, Haredi-looking orthodoxy, which is not open to the entire world. That, in other words, I will tell you that at the beginning of the establishment of the conservative movement, they were almost like what is called today, and again, I'm recording, that's not a problem, because I can say that, almost like what modern orthodoxy is today. Almost like what modern orthodoxy is today. I can explain why. But almost like modern orthodoxy, they said, wait, we need to blend the worlds. First of all, we're Jews. First of all, we believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu and in God. We have our Torah. Again, that's what happened. I'm not saying this is what's happening today, but this is what happened before. They say, we have God. We have our Torah, but we need to be open to the entire world. And we need to work in free occupations. We need to work outside of a shtetl. We need to move to the big city. And this is what happened. And guess it or not, the conservative movement prospered the moment it was developed. In America, it was the biggest movement in America. We need to understand that. I think also today it's still bigger than the Orthodoxy, even though now it's the smallest one. But it's still bigger. Still bigger than Orthodoxy. It was amazing. It was huge. Huge. Reform today is bigger than conservative, but conservative was the biggest movement in America. But as fast as they grew up, as fast as they declined down. What? Why? What happened? That brings us back to where we started. When we pay respect to our generations before us, when we decide what halacha is, when we are very cautious in changing halacha, that means halacha will change very, very, very slow. Very slow. And what today changes in orthodoxy? For example, halacha for women. Today there is yeshivas, orthodox yeshivas for women like Maharat in New York. They're orthodox and they're giving. Again, it's a drop in the sea, but it's a beginning of something where women can start becoming morot halacha, halacha teachers. The conservative movement made it already 60 years ago. It's not a new thing for them. All right? But in the orthodoxy, this change took more 60 years more because of the respect that we have to the system. Because the system is important. And the slower the system works, the more strong and solid and established this change will. The moment we change something so fast, and again, the conservative movement based their halacha, their change, for example, drive to shul on Shabbos. All right? This is the halacha. Again, I learned this halacha. I learned this psak. There was a huge psak, I think 100 pages, like an Orthodox psak. But their conclusion was, you can drive to Shabbos to shul on Shabbos only if you live very far and you have no other way to get to shul. But when you change halacha, and this is a legit halachic sentence, we need to understand that. There's some rabbis would agree with it. That's fine. They paid respect to the generation before them. But the moment you do it and you don't realize what impact it can have on the people, then from being only a permission to drive to Shabbos when you don't have any other choice, it becomes a normal. Oh, wow, my rabbi told me I can drive on Shabbos. I heard my friend He told me that his cousin could drive on Shabbos because he broke his leg. That's amazing. Oh, I don't feel good. I have headache today. Should I drive to Shabbos? Yes, I know. There is permission. I heard this rabbi who said once, oh, that's fine. I can drive on Shabbos all the way until today. And I'm really simplifying it. But yes, today, most of the conservatives, and again, I don't know what happened in Toronto. I'm not familiar with Toronto. I'm familiar more with the conservative movement in the state, drive on Shabbos to shul. Not talking about the East Coast, in the West Coast. In the West Coast, it's even worse. They still have instruments on Shabbos. They're more like Reform. It's something else. But again, the rabbis, the early rabbis, and you can still find them today, very old, 70s, 80s years old rabbis, who even learned from Heschel maybe, back then they're still more conservative so-called, than new rabbis and the new generations. Because conservative movement, the moment you make those changes in halacha very fast, the fastest you lose your audience. And the fastest the system just breaks down. So I'm not saying in 50 years from now, we probably will be closer to conservative Judaism than ever before. Even today, we're still closer. Not everyone. There's Haredim, there's more Frumin Orthodoxy. I'm talking about modern Orthodox. In general, they're still closer. All right? In terms of Frumin, even the Haredi have their changes inside of it. Culturalized, religiously, we will be closer. But the question is, how do you make those changes? How much respect do you pay to the generations before you and to how much you're connected to your audience? And you say, wait, sometimes things can never change. Sometimes things can never change, or they change slowly. I'll give you an example. Those halachas that once they were so cautious, the conservative rabbis were so cautious in permitting driving on Shabbos, for example, or permitting a woman to become a rabbi, which was the new 50 years ago. They had the psak of a woman becoming a rabbi. Today there is psakim of the conservative movement, of the JTS, that a rabbi can perform a chuppah between two males, for example, or between two females. For example, even interreligion marriage, also interfaith marriage, also something that is permitted in some of the conservative shuls. And I think personally that if their rabbis back then, the generations before, two generations before us, would see those piskei halacha, they would be devastated. They would be devastated of what happened to this movement, how much cautious they were, and how much they hold the thing that I would say the value of Torah min Hashamayim, of halacha changes slowly and from psakim, to how very fast it all changes today. And again, I think it's a pity. I don't think it's something that is mevorach, because halacha changes. Totally agree with the conservative movement. Just the question is how. And the question is, how much do you push this halacha to change? All right, we're good with that. Any questions so far?
When you talk about conservative reform, orthodox around the world, from what I understand, Toronto, which seems to be one of the most, it's not the largest, but one of the larger Jewish communities in the diaspora, conservatism is the predominant type of synagogue in Toronto, followed by orthodox. And I think there's only three reform. Actually, speaking of which, when I mentioned about facing west, the Bima, is the Holy Law Awesome, the only one that faces west, or is it atypical for Reform synagogues to face west? Because the Holy Blossom does. They were going to reorient it facing east toward Jerusalem, but they just decided not to. So do you know if there's...
I don't know about the west. I have no idea. I've never visited Holy Blossom, so I don't know what happened there and what happens in other places.
It's pretty large shul.
It's pretty large. I heard it's pretty large, yes.
Faces Calgary.
What?
The Bima faces Calgary. it's northwest.
Yeah. Northwest. I would say...
It may be unique. But again, I'm just wondering about other jurisdictions in the U.S. I understand that reform is the predominant one, followed by Orthodox, with conservatism as being the smallest.
Even smaller than conservatism, you have today the Reconstructionists. And we did not talk about the Reconstructionism.
And some, ask about that.
Yeah, we did not talk about it as well. In general, the Reconstructionism would say something totally different. They would say, we're Jews, we will observe almost all halacha, but not because we believe in God, but because it's our culture. Very simplifying it, all right? We want halacha, but because it's our culture, not because it's a divine law from God, in general.
So based on your previous lectures, halacha dictates are malleable over time, whereas the 613 mitzvot are it's static.
Good. Thank you for asking this. Reform, conservative, and orthodoxy. As far as I know, in general, as they declare they are, all agree on mitzvot. All right? So all agree on mitzvot.
Those 613.
As far as they declare themselves, also reform. Reform, what they did, reform said, wait, we have halacha, but we have mitzvot. In other words, we have Torah Kohanim, we have the priest Torah, which is the law, the halacha, and we have Torah Nevi'im, which is our moral Torah, which is our values, which is the thing. And they said, the moral Torah is the thing that is you're obligated to perform in your daily life. While the other thing is for your reshut. What it's called, you can choose if you want to do it or not. It's not an obligation. But they all agree that the mitzvot, as far as I know, I don't know, again, maybe they're going to be different rabbis. As far as they declare themselves, mitzvah is something they know. They know that if you respect your parents, you perform the mitzvah. Doesn't matter if you're reform, conservative, or if some would say reform that don't believe in God would say, yeah, well, you perform the mitzvah, but what is the mitzvah? Because God doesn't need your mitzvot. Maybe there's no God. Maybe you did something good to the world. They will probably interpret it differently. But in terms of having mitzvot, everyone agrees of mitzvot. The question is halachically. Halacha is the question in that case. And how halacha changes, who can change halacha, and who can cancel halacha in that case. And in that, there is three different changes in our world today between Orthodox, Reform, and Conservative, just like there was changes back then in the Second Temple, halachically wise, between Purushim, Tzedokim, and Issim. Now, what will happen 1,000 years ahead? Maybe a new groups will survive from those three groups today? As far as it seems today, who will survive after the three is Orthodox. It's the only one that's not shrinking. All right? That's the only one that predicts it's not shrinking. What will happen? But inside Orthodoxy, there's different diverses now. They're branching out. There are different streams. There are different sections within Orthodoxy itself. So what we call Orthodoxy today, the chances that we would call the same group Orthodox in 30 years, 50 years from now, is not a big chance. Not big chances that it would call the same thing. And again, I did not talk about the Sephardim. Sephardim did not have reform. Maybe that's a good thing to say now. In Edot HaMizrach, the Sephardic community, they're not Orthodox. We need to understand that. Originally, they're not Orthodox. Why? Because again, Orthodoxy is a movement that branched out from Judaism after they saw the response of what happened with reform. Well, if you don't have reforms, you don't have Orthodoxy. All right? And you did not have reform in North Africa. There were no reforms in North Africa. Now, there's amazing, astonishing books written lately from I can recommend it in Hebrew, unfortunately, but I can recommend it if you want to read in Hebrew, about why exactly there was not reform movement in North Africa. What changes? In what terms that North African Judaism Jewry is different than the European one that they did not have this movement of change? And more than that, they have some things that we don't have because of reform. I would say, for example, they had rabbis, women. They had women rabbis back then. We know about different rabbi Pircha, Frecha. We know about different rabbis in Morocco, for example. For example, in Morocco, and they were women. We know of a woman who ran a Beis Midrash. She was a Rosh Yeshiva. Now we're talking about 180 to 200 years ago. All right? So what exactly is the difference between reform and why not? I would say that also the reason that halacha changes slower today in our world is due to reform. Because what we see, what the reforms have done and the conservatives today have done, the rabbis today are more cautious in changing halacha. More cautious. In other words, if we were be like the Sephardim back then, and again, the moment the state of Israel was established, it's all mixed up, Sephardim are Orthodox. I think I told you the story. No, if maybe I told you, maybe not, I will tell it again, that my mother doesn't cover her hair. She goes with her hair without a hair covering. And once we went to a Shabbos, to a hotel, there was a bar mitzvah in that hotel, and we went to shul on Shabbos morning. And my mom forgot her hair covering. She usually covers her hair when she comes to shul. She forgot her hair covering when she comes to shul. And she went to the woman's section, and a woman, she doesn't know her, afterwards she understood she's a family of this bar mitzvah, came up to her and told her, Galit, matosa, echat, she didn't call her Galit, she didn't know her name, but said, matosa, echat nichneset lebet hakneset lelo kisui rosh. How come you enter shul without covering your head, lady? How do you do that? Oy vay vay. And then, 5 minutes later, that same woman took off her phone on Shabbos from her wallet and took a picture of the bar mitzvah. Now, why do I tell you this story? This is the story of Sephardic Judaism in Israel. Why there were Sephardim? Why that's the story? Because it's wow, this is a huge, huge explanation. I don't think we have time for that now. But in Israel, what happened after they had their aliyot to Israel? And they saw that in general, most of the Jews in Israel are Orthodox, right? They came from Europe before them. They're Orthodox. The reform and the conservative movement in Israel are so tiny. They're very, very, very tiny. They're growing, by the way. If there's a future for the reform movement, it's in Israel right now, because it's growing in Israel. And when they saw, when they encounter the Orthodoxy, from this collision, something happened. There is a huge group, I think the biggest today, group in Israel, are what we call Masortiim. Masortiim in Israel, not to be confused with the Masorti movement, which is a conservative movement in Israel, but the Masortiim, the traditional Jews, are Jews who are so much into halacha, they want to observe every inch of the halacha, but they say, it's hard for us. I'm sorry. We adore those who observe halacha. I wish I would marry a religious woman. I wish my children would be sent into a religious school, and they send them. But we cannot observe halacha. It's difficult. And from this kind of movement that tried to, and they succeeded in that, to combine between the very solid Jewish Torah identity on the one hand, and on the other hand, secularism, they managed to create this group who, for example, make every Shabbos kiddush. There is no Shabbos they will miss not making a kiddush. They will go to shul for Kabbalat Shabbat and for Mariv on Shabbos evening. They will come back home. They will make kiddush, and then they will drive in to see the soccer game at the stadium. That's a fascinating movement. It's the biggest one in Israel today. Most of them are Sephardic. Most of them are Sephardim. Are they Orthodox? Are they conservative? Are they Reform? They're neither of those three. There's something new, something else. It's the biggest movement in Israel. They call themselves Orthodox. In that way that they say, because they were so influenced by the Orthodoxy, that woman at shul, when she saw my mother without not covering her hair, that was like the most, that was a disaster. A disaster. How come? We're Reform, you're not covering your hair? Every woman should cover her hair when she comes to shul. But, you know, a phone Shabbos, I don't think she would say, I don't think HaKadosh Baruch Hu would be so angry if I'm using my phone. I'm not violating, I'm not driving on Shabbos, I'm not in bed, I don't know, I'm not cooking on Shabbos. Another example, one of my best friends from Tzava, from the army, she is Sephardic and she's secular. She doesn't eat kosher. She doesn't eat meat and cheese together, she doesn't eat pork, but she can sit down and eat in a not kosher restaurant where they serve pork and meat and cheese. She will order something kosher in her eyes. She will order just meat. When she travels abroad, she eats everywhere. She eats in every restaurant. She eats almost everything. She will try not to eat pork. If there is pork and she doesn't know it, she will eat. She eats everywhere. But she would not eat what is called chalav nuchri. Chalav nuchri is milk, dairy that came out of a cow that is owned by a Gentile. She would not eat it. No dairy drinks outside. She would eat meat.
Chalav Yisrael.
Chalav Yisrael is the opposite of Chalav Nuchri, yes. A Gentile meal. She will only eat Chalav Yisrael and only abroad. Why? Because this is a tradition that she got from her parents and this is what she preserved. There is no, she's not going to move an inch out of this tradition. That's why they're called Masortim. Are they Orthodox? Maybe, maybe not. It's a new thing. They're not conservative, they're not reformed, they're not reconstructionist. But we need to understand that in their eyes, halacha changes. Not because a rabbi told you to change halacha, not because you choose to change halacha, and this opens us to the fifth meeting, Bezrat Hashem, because their family had a tradition, and her parent changed the halacha. And this is a thing that I want to talk about. So just Ira, I will give you in a minute, just to wrap up everything that we said today, alright? Just to wrap it up. Again, halacha changes. Halacha is not static. Halacha changes and evolves, and it has evolved and it will evolve. We're not the same Jews today as our grand-grand-grandparents were. We're different. We're observing halacha differently. But how do we change halacha? We first of all pay respect to the generations before us. We make it slowly and only when we have the authority. Only when we have authority to change something, when we see that halacha is like, I'll give you, halacha is like a river. It streams, all the way it streams. Sometimes it branches out. But when it branches out, it's still connected to the source of water. It would never just start a new branch with disconnecting itself from the source of water. Because when the moment a river branches out and disconnects from its source of water, it dries. It dries. We always branch out, but we always stay connected to our roots. We always stay connected to our values. And again, I think this is one of the bad things that today happened in other movements in Judaism, that I think they tried to rush a little bit and they a little bit of dried themselves from the source of water. And Bezrat Hashem, may every change that we do and every halacha decision that we do would be from the idea and from the ideal of the same source of water and the same source of life of Torah, Bezrat Hashem.
Okay.
Yes.
Very quickly, so we now know